Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in the City of Lancaster versus Chambers.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Poe, will present argument for the petitioner.
The petitioner has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. I'd like to go through a brief description of the facts in the case. The accident underlying this lawsuit occurred at 2:30 on a Saturday night in DeSoto, Texas, in August of 1986. The respondent, Bradley Chambers, was a passenger on a motorcycle driven by a friend of his named Scott Stiles. The two young men, while looking directly at DeSoto police officer C.P. Bentley, who was sitting in an intersection in his police unit, the two youths looked right at Officer Bentley and then ran through a red light there in the city of DeSoto. Officer Bentley turned on his emergency lights and sirens and began a pursuit of the motorcycle. Stiles and Chambers fled the pursuit, and another DeSoto officer joined the chase. Despite the lights and sirens of all of the police units involved, Stiles and Chambers continued to flee the pursuit, and at one point, in fact, jumped a curb, went for a while the wrong way down a one-way street, wound up going the right way again on the street, and then led the chase toward I-35 near DeSoto. The DeSoto officers thought that Stiles and Chambers might enter the city of Lancaster on the other side of I-35, so they radioed the city of Lancaster and asked for officers in that city to be ready for the chase to come in that direction. Instead of crossing into Lancaster, however, Stiles and Chambers turned south on I-35 and proceeded south down I-35 and led the chase onto that interstate. It's undisputed that in the chase, the Lancaster units and the DeSoto units all had their lights and sirens operating during the entire period of the chase. The evidence indicates that the chase was in the neighborhood of 70 or 80 miles an hour on I-35. The DeSoto officers were equipped with propane-powered police cars. These are less powerful than gas-driven cars, and they fell behind the motorcycle on I-35.
And all of this for the running of a red light?
That's correct, Your Honor, except that Stiles and Chambers continued to flee even after they saw or must have seen Officer Bentley's lights and sirens, which of course should have indicated to them that a peace officer wanted them to stop for a traffic infraction. I think it's also important that Officer Bentley very clearly testified both young men looked straight at him as they ran the red light.
What difference does it make?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's been some characterization that merely running a red light doesn't justify a chase of this nature. What we'd like to make clear is that 99% of us stop when an officer wants us to. These young men didn't. When they continued to flee the pursuit, they broke other laws and challenged the authority of these officers in their jurisdiction. We think that's important. Bradley Chambers, eventually the Lancaster officers passed the DeSoto officers in the chase, the Lancaster officers having the gas-driven vehicles, and the chase proceeded down I-35. Bradley Chambers testified that at one point on I-35, he could see a police car 5 to 10 feet behind him. Officer Bentley in the 1st DeSoto unit testified a little bit differently. He said that the unit of Lancaster Officer Powell passed him on I-35 and took up a position about 5 to 6 car lengths behind the motorcycle. Eventually, Stiles and Chambers slowed down and pulled over to the right side of I-35 as though to stop. But then an Officer Powell at that point in the 1st police unit behind the motorcycle likewise slowed and moved over to the right, thinking that they were going to stop. But instead of doing so, they rapidly accelerated and left Officer Powell and the rest of the police units behind. A short time later, Stiles and Chambers exited I-35 at an extremely high speed. Officer Powell in the 1st police unit was some 200 to 225 yards behind the chase at that point. Stiles lost control of the motorcycle off of the service road at the exit and crashed into a signpost. He was killed and Bradley Chambers was injured.
They didn't know until later on that Chambers had a felony arrest warrant outstanding?
That's correct, Your Honor. Only the motorcycle was involved in the accident. It's clear that there was no police roadblock at that exit or on the service road. It's also clear there was no physical contact at any point between the police units and the motorcycle. And it's clear that the officers never forced the motorcycle's direction or movement or brought their police units into a position to dictate the motorcycle's movement. Of course, the trial court granted a summary judgment for our cities and officers on all of the chamber's claims. The Dallas Court of Appeals initially reversed and remanded all the claims, but then upon rehearing reversed the summary judgment on the chamber's common law claims, but affirmed the summary judgment with respect to their Section 1983 civil rights claims. And this, of course, this court has granted application on the common law claims for our side, and of course has granted the application for the respondents on their Section 1983 claims. I'd like to address the official immunity points at this time during my argument, except to the extent I think there are some parallels between the official immunity analysis and the Section 1983 analysis, and then Mr. Pinker will address the Section 1983 points in rebuttal to the Chamber's counsel's argument. Our position in the case is that the summary judgment evidence our officers offered in support of the motion for summary judgment entitled them to official immunity as a matter of law, and that therefore the officers cannot be held liable, and likewise the cities cannot be held liable. We've cited several cases in support of this proposition in our briefs and also in the letter brief that we filed with the court this morning. The main cases we rely on are Carpenter versus Barner, which is in our brief, Edgar versus Plummer, which we've cited in our letter brief filed this morning, and Dent versus City of Dallas. All three cases, we feel, very strongly and accurately state the position that the officer's pursuit, arrest, and traffic stop decisions are entitled to official immunity under official immunity doctrine in the state of Texas.
I need to be sure that I understand the scope of that argument then. If instead of the claimant here being, I guess, someone, a family of someone who had total disrespect for authority, we had a minister and a carload of deacons returning from a revival late at night, and they either get hit by the motorcycle or they swerve off the road taking evasive action as a result of this chase. You would cloak the police who gave the decision to engage in this high-speed chase on a highway while running a red light total and complete immunity from any action that they might have against that policeman or the city.
Your Honor, I think what's important is, and this is a distinction you mentioned in your question, this is a different case where the police officer's vehicles were not involved in the accident, and the suspect's vehicle inflicts the damages. I think that's an important distinction.
And that was the nature of my question.
I understand, Your Honor, but the limitation we would offer the court, and we've offered it in our briefs, is based upon prior Texas official immunity law, and I think it's very reasonable. That is, in pursuit, arrest, and stop decisions such as those involved in this case, and as were involved in the Travis case that preceded this one, the officers are entitled to official immunity if they show probable cause or good faith or whatever the standard we articulate, except to the extent the claimants can show that the officers acted willfully or maliciously with respect to inflicting injury or damage. And I think that is a limitation we would argue for, and I think it's a fair one based upon prior official immunity law in Texas.
So the answer to my question about the minister and deacons coming back from the revival is that they would be barred in their claim unless the policeman who gave chase for running the red light wanted to hurt them and acted maliciously toward them.
I think a willful or malicious standard is what we've argued for, Your Honor. And I think, again, that it is supported by prior official immunity law. And that's the burden we would put the claimant to in a case such as this where the officer's vehicle does not inflict the injury or damage.
Chambers was the passenger on a motorcycle?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are there any special rules as to pursuing a motorcycle vehicle as opposed to a car or truck?
Not that I've seen in the case law, Your Honor. It may be that there are some factual distinctions that would be looked over on a case-by-case basis, but I haven't seen any illustration in the cases that there's any difference. Of course, I think as the court would recognize, a motorcycle at a high rate of speed is very capable of inflicting injury on others as well as the passengers or drivers of the motorcycle.
Same rule, I guess, would apply to a motorcycle that got a parking ticket, tore it up right in front of the officer, and sped off?
Well, Your Honor, I think a...
Just with a total disrespect for authority.
Well, I'm not sure...
Violation of the law.
Violation of the law, I think, is the key, Your Honor. And the effort with emergency lights and sirens to indicate to the fleeing suspect that a peace officer of the state wants that person to stop for detention.
Would the same bar apply then if the officer put on his lights and sirens and there had been no violation of the law?
Well, Your Honor, I think we can take care of that type of analysis under our willful or malicious standard.
No, I'm not suggesting the officer was willful or malicious. Perhaps he just wanted to do a driver's license check.
Your Honor, I think that our position would be when a police officer, absent willful or malicious intent to do harm or inflict injury, asks a citizen of the state to stop in accordance with emergency procedures, then yes, the same analysis would apply if a chase ensues from the suspect's refusal to stop.
The Court of Appeals seemed to decide that no official immunity could be had in this case because the police officers exceeded any discretion they might have had. This was not a discretionary activity on their part. The older cases seem to make a distinction merely between ministerial and discretionary, and I was wondering, are there any other alternatives other than a ministerial act and a discretionary act for a police officer under these circumstances?
I think there is, Your Honor. And what's interesting is that the cases are developing fairly nicely upon the analysis that immunity applies to quasi-judicial officials exercising their discretionary decision-making authority in decisions that affect the administration or enforcement of government. I think that's important because it helps us distinguish between acts or officials that, whether you call it ministerial rather than discretionary or whatever analysis you apply, the issue is the type of decision-making that we're trying to protect with immunity, the type of decision-making that involves the enforcement and administration of government. Clearly, a police officer's decisions in whether, when, and how to arrest a fleeing criminal suspect, we feel, are those types of decisions. Some of the other cases illustrate that...
Are discretionary?
Well, I think clearly so, Your Honor. And the Edgar versus Plummer case that we cited this morning, as well as this court's concurrence in Travis, makes it very clear that an officer's arrest and pursuit decisions can be and should be regarded as discretionary.
I'm not sure whether I hear you correctly. If I do hear you correctly, then you're saying that so long as it's discretionary, there's no burden or no duty on these officers to act with due regard for the safety of all persons, as 6701D requires.
Your Honor, I think what you've mentioned, 6701D, the traffic statute, is a standard of care statute, and we would concede that. And of course, this court...
So they're not immune if they don't exercise the standard of care.
Well, Your Honor, our position...
Well, they are immune even if they don't exercise the standard of care. Which are you saying?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that they're immune even if they arguably violated a due regard standard of care set up by the traffic
statute. Then what purpose is there in having 6701D on the books? What did the legislature intend by putting it there? That it just, hey, these are cautionary words, go act with due regard, but you're immune even if you don't?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the statute is important and serves several purposes. We've cited the Thornton versus Shore case in our brief, in our reply brief, a case out of the Kansas Supreme Court that very clearly recognized that these due regard statutes, which are fairly uniform from state to state, apparently with some sort of model code that was developed and adopted, the due regard statutes apply to situations in which the officer inflicts damages with his or her own vehicle. And I think the analysis
is
there...
Really material, which bullet hits you?
Mr. Hope, let me ask you a question. Sorry.
That's
at
right.
What point, with regard to due regard...
Can you answer my question first?
Sorry,
go ahead. Your answer, Justice Gamage's question.
Justice Gamage, I think the important thing is, and in fact, we've also cited a recent shooting case in our letter brief this morning, I think in a chase case, it is important which vehicle inflicts the damages for this reason. Under the Court of Appeals analysis in this case, the court relies upon a 1957 Eastland Court of Appeals decision called Eubanks. And Eubanks was a contact case in which the officer was clearly negligent and allowed his own vehicle to collide with the claimant. I think what's important about that is the officer in that situation is being examined as a driver, as the operator of a motor vehicle, and he's subject to the same standard as any other driver. There may be some question whether that applies in an emergency situation. We've cited the Terrell brief in our case in our briefs that illustrate there may be some question in that regard. But for the purposes of today's case, I think it's a critical distinction because if the officers don't inflict damages with their own vehicles in the context of a pursuit case, but the suspect does, the only thing the officers are doing, frankly, is their jobs. They're pursuing a fleeing criminal suspect who has refused to stop despite a show of lawful police authority. So if we have to draw a line, I think that's a logical and rational place to draw it. If you don't
do that. In other words, in exercising this due regard, they only have to worry about it today yet. They don't have to be concerned about the danger that this chase may impose upon the driving or walking or sitting or standing or sitting in your living room in public from the person being chased.
Your Honor, I think that's accurate, except to the extent that we've offered in our briefs this limitation, again, which I think is consistent with prior Texas official immunity law, that an officer can, or a public official can, be shown to have been willful or malicious with respect to a situation that creates injury or damage. So there is an upper limit on what an officer can do under the standard that we tried to outline in our brief. But for the most part, I agree that is our position, that in a situation where the officer is merely pursuing, he or she is simply exercising their discretionary decision-making authority in the enforcement or execution of government.
They don't have to exercise due regard in the exercise of that discretion.
Your Honor, they do for the purposes of inflicting damage with their own vehicle. I think 6701D also means that the officer can't be issued a ticket. I mean, there's a certain logical place for 6701D, but it is simply a traffic statute. And I might point out also that if the Texas Tort Claims Act does not abrogate official immunity, and it specifically does not, Section 101.106 provides that it does not, I don't think there's any good argument that a traffic statute abrogates official immunity. But if it does, then it flies in the face of this Court's concurrence in Travis, which very clearly recognized that an officer's pursuit and arrest decisions are uniquely discretionary, uniquely involved in the enforcement and administration of government, and therefore should be cloaked with immunity even if negligence is present.
I appreciate it, but the concurrence was only joined by three justices. But I do have a question about the what the Court of Appeals did. And the Court of Appeals appeared to say because there was evidence that the officers acted without due regard to the safety of others, that defeated the affirmative defense of official immunity. Am I correct, or do you agree that the Court of Appeals appeared to confuse the plaintiff's cause of action for breach under the statute or evidence of negligence as defeating an affirmative defense?
I agree, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals analysis is subject to one of two readings. Justice Thomas either said that official immunity is not available in pursuit cases at all, or she said that the officers would not be entitled to official immunity if the trier of fact determines that the officers may have breached the standard of care.
I suppose the allegation will always be made in these types of cases that the officers acted without due regard for the safety of others. And if that's right, and if that defeats official immunity, is that tantamount to saying that there is no official immunity in a police chase situation?
I think it is, Your Honor. And I think what's important about that is that the official immunity is recognized as immunity from suit, not simply immunity from having to appear in a case. The legislature has enacted Section 51.014 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which provides that there is an interlocutory appeal from the denial of a motion for summary judgment based on official immunity. The important thing is official immunity exists so that officers are free from suit.
not just that they shouldn't have to go through a jury trial because that will chill their administration and enforcement of government policy and interests.
Mr. Hogue, I had a question about, let's kind of follow through some of this thinking. At what point did the police officers fail? I mean, you're saying they're immune to begin with, but let's assume that there was some negligence here at some point by the police officers. Where would this have occurred? Did it occur at the point the red light was run and they turned on their sirens, which they should not have done? Or did it occur at some point where they determined that this gentleman on the motorcycle was going to be reckless and race away from them, and therefore the chase should not occur? Or did it occur out there on the highway where there's high-speed traffic to begin with, when they went the wrong way on a street, and they continue to chase? Or at what point do we say that a police officer in this whole series of events, which at what point did they cross over from conducting proper police procedures to exercising a lack of due regard in the attempt to apprehend a fleeing suspect?
Your Honor, I think the claimants in these cases are going to argue that the negligence could and did occur at each of those junctures. Our position is that regardless of what the claimants argue, if all they can establish is negligence, whether it's initial in deciding to pursue the suspect at all. Frankly, I don't think that that's even an arguable negligence situation. If an officer observes a violation, turns on his or her lights and siren and pursues, I'm not sure how that can be negligence at all. But if there's negligence later in the scenario, if the speed of the chase increases or there's increased recklessness on the part of a fleeing suspect, our position is it doesn't matter as long as the officer's conduct does not rise to the level of willful or malicious infliction of injury or damage. I think that's consistent with official immunity law in Texas, and as well has some parallels with the Section 1983 analysis, which Mr. Pinker will address, in which there is no liability absent a roadblock or physical contact with the suspect's vehicle.
Any other questions?
Yes. Counsel, you didn't get to good faith, but let me just ask you about that element of official immunity. You differ from the standard proposed in the Travis concurrence because it incorporates an objective element, and you say it's essentially the same as a negligence standard. But hasn't the United States Supreme Court had run into the same problem about in dealing with qualified immunity and how you can provide this immunity from suit and yet allow for the competing interests of the parties to be adequately weighed under these circumstances? In other words, if it's just subjective, then the officer is going to get a summary judgment, at least as the element of good faith, in every case, aren't they?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so. They'll get it in many cases, and of course that's our position, that they should.
Oh, there's no way for the plaintiff to impeach or otherwise delve into the mindset of the officer, and if the officer is going to be able to establish his mindset as a matter of law, isn't that the problem?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two responses. We don't argue for a purely subjective assessment of good faith or compliance with what would amount to good faith under Section 1983 analysis. But I think the important thing, if you draw a parallel between the Section 1983 analysis and official immunity analysis, is in 1983 cases, there can be no liability absent a seizure of the suspect's vehicle. In other words, absent a roadblock or the officer contacting that vehicle or forcing it to stop. I think there are very critical, important parallels to official immunity analysis where we had the same situation. Our officers didn't do any of those things. Now, on the other hand, we would not argue that there can be no liability. We would argue only that there's immunity and no liability as long as the officers didn't act willfully or maliciously. And in our reply brief, we suggested, and we certainly don't, we're not trying to take the opportunity to point out what would amount to willful or malicious conduct, but I think there are aspects of chase pursuit cases that a claimant could utilize in an attempt to show that the officer's conduct rose to the level of willful or malicious infliction of injury. And I could point out also, Your Honor, that under prior official immunity analysis in Texas, that's been the standard anyway. So if a claimant wants to survive an official immunity defense in those situations where its elements are established, they do have to show willful or malicious conduct. Hope that answers the question.
What about the latter part of 6701D, going beyond the due regard for the safety of all persons, specifically the provision says that the foregoing provisions authorizing the officers to use their emergency lights and chase offenders or suspects do not relieve the driver of an authorized emergency vehicle from the duty to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons. It goes on to say, nor shall such provisions protect the driver from the consequences of his reckless disregard for the safety of others. What does that mean?
Your Honor, that may mean that in addition to establishing a due regard standard of care for the purposes of duty of care and then breach of that standard of care, the reckless disregard language may mean that in a situation where the officer's vehicle actually inflicts the injury or damage, the officer can be held liable for negligence and gross negligence. Or it may simply mean, it may just simply be a different formulation of due regard. I think the critical thing about 6701D...
Well, due regard is one standard. I think reckless disregard is probably goes beyond that. It's not only did you not exercise due regard, you had a reckless disregard.
I think that's, I believe that's correct.
Waiting, for instance, with gross negligence, perhaps.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, some states, and it's difficult to get an idea of what every state is doing in this area because many of them base their decisions on codifications of official immunity.
Well, I'm concerned about the consequences here. It says, shall not protect the driver from the consequences of his recklessness. There's no limit on that word in the statute. But you find it entrapping. Criminal consequences, civil consequences, anything consequences. In other words, that would seem to be a total waiver of any kind of immunity that might be asserted.
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think, again, the critical thing about 6701D is it's simply a traffic statute, and I don't mean to belittle the statute at all, but I think what's important is
that... But it's the statute that permits police officers to give chase.
That's correct, Your Honor. It permits them to exceed the speed limit and exercise the other legal...
They have no permission outside of the statute to do that.
Well, Your Honor, our argument is not that Article 6701D entitles us to official immunity, that if we've got our lights and sirens operating, we can exceed the speed limit and we don't have any liability. That was a mistake the officer made in the Eubanks case in their argument. Our argument is 6701D goes to the standard of care, and if we breach that standard, maybe we were negligent. But the critical thing is, under official immunity doctrine, we're protected even if we were negligent, and that's the nature of any affirmative defense.
It seems to me 6701D is the very statute that says you can do these things, but you have to do these things with a due regard, and you may not exercise especially a reckless disregard for the safety of all others, including yourself, including your passengers, including innocent people, including the person you're pursuing, or passengers who are riding with that person. It says all persons. The public general. And it's the only statute that gives the officers authority to give chase of this sort. And when they do, they have to exercise this due regard. If they fail to do that, and they're still under the umbrella of official immunity, what purpose is that safeguard language in there?
Your Honor, as we've mentioned in our reply brief, the Thornton case, we feel very accurately reasons this problem out, and states that the statute serves a very legitimate purpose in that it governs an officer's conduct when he or she inflicts damages with their own vehicle. So
it doesn't seem to, I don't see that anywhere in the statute.
I agree, Your Honor. It's not explicit in the statute's language, but I think it's the Thornton case particularly gives a very reasoned analysis of why that is so. It's simply a different case. And when an officer inflicts damages with his or her own vehicle, apparently they are examined as any other Texas motorist would be. They have control over that situation. But the only control they have over a pursuit case in which the suspect's vehicle inflicts the damage is not to give chase. And our position is that's too important a type of decision-making to impose negligence liability when that is intrinsically involved in the administration and enforcement of government. that the type of decision we argue must be protected by official immunity.
Private citizen gave similar checks. He would not have any protection.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
From criminal prosecution or civil consequences. And it's only this statute that permits law enforcement authorities to give this type of checks, but it seems to be a qualified permission.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank you. The court is ready to hear arguments from Ms. Robbins.
May I please support Mr. David Weiner will present arguments for the respondent?
Court, bear with me for one moment. May it please the court. I'm David Weiner, counsel for the Chambers family. I think that Justice Gamage has put his finger on the critical point in this case, which is this statute, which is the same thing on both sides here. The statute which provides that police officers have certain privileges in these high-speed pursuit cases when they're pursuing actual or suspected criminals, but that those privileges have to be exercised under certain conditions, which is exactly what the statute says.
So if an officer violates this statute, they can't, official immunity is not even a consideration?
It's not a consideration because the statute, exactly, because the statute says that they can't exceed the maximum speed limit so long as they do not endanger life or property.
Well, isn't official immunity an affirmative defense? Do you agree with that? No?
I do agree with that.
So if someone's negligent, then we don't look to see whether the defendant can establish an affirmative defense. We just merely decide whether the officer violated the statute.
Well, the point is, the threshold question is whether an officer is entitled to immunity in these kinds of cases. And the language of the statute makes it clear that they are not.
Now, that's my question. Okay. Is there a common law official immunity doctrine in Texas that this statute limits, or is there no common law official immunity doctrine in Texas, and such as there is granted by the statute?
There is a common law official or qualified immunity doctrine in Texas.
And this statute acts as a limitation on it, or a
definition? It does, but only because the common law also acts as a limitation on that official immunity doctrine for officers in the operation of their vehicles. That's what Eubanks versus Wood said. This statute does not, as counsel for petitioners has stated, establish the standard of due care. It merely reinforces and states that it applies in emergency situations as well as in ordinary driving situations where police officers are operating their vehicle. It reaffirms that police officers or other operators of emergency vehicles shall not be relieved of their duty to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons. In other words, that's a duty that they have in the first place. That's
so
what
is this statute coextensive with the common law official immunity standard?
It's coextensive in the...
Or
in
does
the,
it limit it? Would it? In the absence of this statute, would the police officer have more leeway?
I really don't think so, because if you go back to Eubanks versus Wood, it makes Eubanks versus Wood, which is that decision from the Eastland Court of Civil Appeals in 1957, made it clear that when officers are operating their vehicles, they are not engaged in any kind of official any kind of activity within their official discretion. The point being that driving a vehicle and responding to a call, let's say a non-emergency call, is not considered to be a discretionary activity. Now, of course, police officers
Is it ministerial?
I'm sorry.
How would you characterize it?
I think it would have to be, it has to end up characterizing it as ministerial. Or you could say, alternatively, that the act and the action of operating, of a police officer operating a motor vehicle is not something that is uniquely governmental.
So now, that would be a duty which the law prescribes and defines the duties to be performed with such precision and certainty as to leave nothing to the exercise of discretion or judgment.
That would be characterizing it as ministerial.
Cool. So when a police officer makes chases a fleeing police car, it's a ministerial duty.
Well, there's a distinction to be drawn. And the distinction is that an officer does have a certain degree of or level of discretion in these cases. He's got the discretion to decide.
So it's discretionary?
No. He's got the discretion to decide to pursue the suspect. And he's even got the discretion, because the statute provides for it, to disregard certain traffic laws. But he doesn't have the discretion to drive without due regard for the safety of all persons in the course of disregarding those traffic laws. Because ultimately, operating the motor vehicle remains an act which a police officer has to do with due regard for the safety of all persons. And that is to be judged by a negligence standard, but it is coextensive with official immunity, because what it clearly implies is that an officer doesn't have the discretion to drive without due regard for the safety of all persons.
What I hear you argue is that an officer has no discretion whether to go 50 miles an hour in the chase or 80 miles an hour in the chase. Is that what you're arguing?
He does have that discretion because the statute says that they may exceed the maximum speed limit.
Well, at some point between 50 and 80, you know, he crosses a line of due regard for the safety of others. But you're saying he has no discretion within that 50 and 80 window.
Well, it's not a line that's crossed. Considering this question in a vacuum, it's a line that may be crossed considering all the circumstances where the fact of this emergency pursuit or pursuit of suspects is one of the factors that has to be taken into account in the negligence determination, whether an officer has exercised due regard. The point is, if an officer exceeds the speed limit or if he goes the wrong way on the street, what the statute does is to insulate that officer not only from, of course, any criminal liability for violating the traffic laws, but we would submit also from any common law or claims based upon the theory of negligence per se.
So what I hear you say then is that these cases can never be resolved on summary judgment. There's always a fact issue as to whether or not the officer has acted negligently.
Well, it's possible that a case could be resolved on summary judgment on the negligence question, but it wouldn't be resolved on the immunity question.
Well, but you're saying there is no immunity.
That's what we're saying.
There is no immunity any time an officer gives chase or is in hot pursuit, and there's an accident to somebody.
With respect to acts of negligence that are directed at the manner in which the officer has operated his motor vehicle.
So if the World Trade Center had blown up in downtown Austin and the officers arriving at the scene saw some fleeing suspects, they could not pursue those suspects and ever expect, as long as there was ultimately an accident in which someone was hurt, they could never obtain summary judgment. They would have to go through a jury trial to determine whether they were negligent under those circumstances.
They could never obtain summary judgment on the affirmative defense of official immunity, but it is of course conceivable that they could obtain summary judgment on the question of whether they were negligent, given the consideration of all the circumstances, including the seriousness of the situation that they're confronted with. But it's not a matter of their immunity, it's a matter of whether they breached the standard of care that's applicable to them as well as to them in non-emergency situations and to, of course, every other operator.
Was there a specific act of negligence here?
Well, there are specific acts of negligence that were alleged.
What was the negligence?
The most critical being the allegation that the police officers were negligent in exceeding the speed limit under the circumstances.
So they ought to watch the speedometer, and when it gets to be 55, what? Say that's it, goodbye?
No, because they were in this emergency mode.
But you say that it's negligence to exceed the speed limit.
No, it's not negligence to exceed the speed limit.
What was the negligence?
I'm saying it's negligence to go as fast. Our allegation is that it's negligence for them to go as fast as they did and to continue to go as fast as they did under the circumstances. It wasn't negligence to exceed the speed limit because the statute says they may exceed the speed limit, but it prescribes certain conditions under which that can be done, that they cannot drive without due regard, and specifically as to exceeding the speed limit, that they may not do so if it endangers life or property.
But if they had exceeded the speed limit and on a straight highway, the motorcycle had blown a tire, and the end result was death and injury. The negligence of exceeding the speed limit would have caused that?
Well, that's a question of proximate cause, but it's not a question about immunity. And I think that it's important for us to emphasize, as we have in our response to the writ application, that this emphasis that the petitioners have upon whether the police officer's vehicle collided with the victim or whether the suspect's vehicle caused the crash is really an issue of proximate cause. It's not immunity because it doesn't have anything to do with discretion.
Counsel, there does seem to be a very legitimate concern that we not impair the ability of law enforcement officers in a situation where we're not talking about a red light or a parking ticket that's torn up, but where there is serious harm to life or perhaps to property as well, and the officer is trying to do his or her job in that situation, and they find that the only thing they get in return is a lawsuit. What? Explain to me. You referenced it, something about summary judgment on negligence. Explain to me how it is, if you don't have a doctrine of immunity applicable here, that the law enforcement officer is not going to be impaired in performing his or her duties in that situation of serious crime by the threat of a lawsuit.
Well, I think that we do have to ultimately come back to basing this on whether it's negligence on the part of the police officers under all the circumstances, including the seriousness of the offense that they have either observed or has been reported to them. But the statute, the legislature has spoken to this, and without regard to the seriousness of an offense or the seriousness of any other kind of emergency, says that due regard must be observed in the driving of the vehicle, and that exceeding the speed limit is permissible if life or property is not endangered. And I don't think there is any other answer except to say that those are questions that have to go into the negligence calculus and perhaps are resolvable at times in summary judgment, but not as a matter of immunity, because both as a matter of common law as well as reinforced by the statute for the emergency situation, the driving of the vehicle by the police officer is not considered to be a discretionary act for which they can be afforded qualified immunity.
Manner in which he drives it, don't you mean?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Manner in which he drives it.
Manner in which he drives it.
Is this a situation where we really have sort of a mixed question of law? In fact, where that which is ministerial merges with that which is discretionary, perhaps that which is discretionary is qualified by that which is ministerial. In other words, he may run red lights, he may exceed the speed limit, he may operate his vehicle in a manner that normally would be criminal if a civilian unauthorized to do so was doing it, but the statute authorized him to do it. He may do this. These are discretionary acts. These are judgment calls on his part, whether to give chase, whether to run that red light, whether to exceed the speed limit, whether to go the wrong way on a one-way street. But the duty to do this with due regard for the safety of all persons is ministerial. He has a ministerial to
duty to operate that vehicle in such a way that he has due regard for the safety of all persons. In other words, qualified immunity applies to discretionary acts, but not beyond the point at which the ministerial duty of due regard is transgressed. And that's really the confusion that comes in, is whether this is a question of law or a question of fact. And that's determined by all the circumstances of a particular case, I would think, including the nature of the offense, the behavior of the suspect, and circumstances of a particular case will be determined, or will determine whether the duty was breached. That's a fact question, isn't it?
Well,
so I think, isn't Justice Gonzalez right? You don't have a heck of a time ever getting a summary judgment in a case like this.
Well, I think if you sum it up accurately, and I think in response to Justice Cornyn's question, that's the distinction that I attempted to draw, the distinction between the discretion whether to pursue, making that decision to pursue, and the decision to exceed the speed limit and disregard other traffic laws, those being discretionary acts, but then past that point in carrying that out, having that ministerial duty or something that both by common law as well as by statute is considered to be non-discretionary.
Counsel, no fireman, no policeman in their right mind will ever engage in a high-speed chase of a fleeing suspect, if you're right. Will they? Why would they subject themselves to the liability exposure? Why not just play it safe and say, I'm staying where I am, and we'll radio ahead and report the incident, but we're not going to chase them because we may be exposed to a judgment individual.
Well, because I think that policemen and firemen are going to consider the gravity of the situation that they face, and they're going to do their duty to pursue or to respond quickly if they believe that's what has to be done. And I think that the prospect of a lawsuit will not deter them, and that they still have protection because they can be confident that under all the circumstances, that the way they've handled the situation has been in a non-negligent manner.
Well, they'll have a good defense to the jury trial.
But they could also have a good defense at the summary judgment phase, even on the negligence question.
How many jury cases? How many summary judgments have you ever seen upheld on the question of whether the defendant was negligent or not?
I agree that there it's not commonplace.
70%, I think, summary judgments are reversed anyway as a group. But wouldn't it be fair to say about 100% of summary judgments granted on negligence issues are reversed?
Well, I don't want to agree that it's 100%, but I think this court has even made clear that these questions relating to negligence and proximate cause can be weeded out and resolved in summary judgments. I mean, that's actually what happened even in Travis versus the City of Mesquite, where two of the officers, I believe it was, who it was shown didn't have anything to do with actually pursuing the suspect, it was held as a matter of law, could not have been the proximate cause of the injury. So it's not as though negligence questions and proximate cause questions, which are related, cannot be determined in summary judgment. They can be.
You make my point exactly. By choosing not to pursue, that's the only option a police officer has.
It wasn't that they chose not to pursue in Travis versus City of Mesquite. What happened was that they were called in and they were going to join up coming in an opposite direction. But it was a matter of choosing not to pursue. It could have been that they had chosen to pursue, but still, as a matter of law, might not have been the proximate cause. But the question is the distinction between, of course, immunity and the proximate cause. And the distinction between the officer colliding with the suspect and somebody else, with the victim, and the suspect colliding with the victim is not the distinction that ought to be relied upon and used as the basis for determining whether officers are entitled to immunity.
Mr. Munger,
that's possibly costly.
You're getting in an area
have a question about. It seems to me your argument really boiled down to just the kernel is that this, the conduct of the driver of this motorcycle just wasn't bad enough to merit a chase. And that's really where we are. And because of that, there's no official immunity here. But it seems to me that is, in fact, the point. We're, in hindsight, evaluating whether or not there was, the conduct was bad enough to merit an 80-mile-an-hour chase out on the freeway, that because the police are in pursuit, the guy driving the motorcycle ultimately has an accident because he's going too fast when he exits the freeway and hurts his passenger. I'm going back to it. Doesn't that entire scenario, well, let's start, was the due regard failed to be exercised at the point the red light was run and they flipped on the light switch that made the guy run? Or was the due regard when he was going the wrong way on the freeway and they chose to chase him there? Or was the due regard when he started to stop on the freeway and they started to stop on the freeway and then he took off and they chose to come and chase him? Don't each one of those steps really require law enforcement exercise of discretion? I could easily see a policeman saying, he ran a red light, I'm going to stop him, I flip on my lights. He's gone on a chase. He's now breaking the speed limit. He's now posing a risk to others. My decision, do I chase him and stop this guy, or do I stop and let him continue 100 miles an hour down the road? What decision? Don't each one of these steps really involve a law enforcement officer's discretion on what do I do now? And isn't that the real purpose of official immunity? And the second question, all of your concerns about a police officer appropriately performing their conduct, could they not be satisfied by, as Mr. Hogue says, an element of malicious or reckless conduct on the part of the police officer that demonstrates that discretion is not a bona fide discretion, but in fact some sort of total disregard of the circumstances that are out there? Isn't that a sufficient protection of the balance of the police officer's duty to protect and serve and an innocent citizen's right to be free from injury as a result of some inappropriate police conduct?
I'm trying to keep up with the questions. I'm gonna go back to the beginning when you posed the question of isn't our complaint really that this wasn't a serious enough matter for the officers to pursue. And that is not our complaint. Because that really only comes into play as if there was immunity and if you had to apply good faith standards and you were to consider the seriousness of the violation or the reported violation in determining whether the officers were acting in good faith in pursuing. But that's not our complaint. Our complaint, and we're not saying that they don't have immunity because this wasn't a serious matter. We're saying they don't have immunity because they don't have the right to be negligent in driving their vehicles in these cases, even if they have the right to exceed the speed limit and to go the wrong way. Now,
but is it part of your contention that if it's serious, that is taken into account in the negligence determination?
Yes.
So if this fellow were a recognized murderer, the police might not be negligent.
That's right.
Or a rapist.
That's right. But it's not an immunity question.
Or a thief.
Or a thief or committed an armed robbery or something.
What level do you, well, there's no way to know, you just have to take it in.
That's something that's variable. I mean, it's not only the seriousness of it, but it's also going to be other circumstances, the conditions under which the chase and the driving were conducted.
Isn't that why we have juries?
Yes.
I mean, you can't say as a matter of law in most of these cases that they didn't breach this duty of due regard. Somebody has to determine when this duty kicked in, when discretion in and duty began.
Correct. Negligence is ordinarily a question of fact.
It's dictated, it's determined by all the surrounding circumstances of this particular case.
The time of day, the amount of traffic, the seriousness of
In this case, when the police officer flipped on the red light, turned on the siren, started after the motorcycle, took off, sped off. The duty may have kicked in at that point. It may have been incumbent upon him to fall back, radio ahead, and say, this guy's coming your way. I'm going to slow down. I don't want to run him through somebody's living room window and see if you can stop him up the road here. It may have been the due regard that was necessary at that point. On the other hand, if it was an armed robber who was blazing bullets all over the neighborhood, getting that sucker out of commission as fast as possible may have been the appropriate behavior.
Correct.
The circumstances of a particular case are going to dictate when that duty kicks in and when it's breached, aren't they?
That's basically the view that we have. If I may take just a moment.
Mr. Weimer, just following up Justice Gamsch's questions, in which you agree in his analysis, the bottom line then is that every time there's a hot pursuit by police officers and there's an injury or damage to property, the officers have bought themselves a lawsuit.
Well, it's true that they're going to, that they could face a lawsuit, but it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily have to go to trial. And they're only going to have to go to trial, of course, if they
How can there ever be a summary judgment if you're alleging negligence and there are fact issues are joined?
Well,
how can it ever be resolved on summary judgment?
Well, the facts can be so clear-cut, or there can be a failure to controvert and raise a fact issue with respect to negligence. No negligence can be established as a matter of law. If I may take just a few moments to address the two points on which the court granted our application for writ of error.
Josh, what are your two points? Without too much argument.
Well, the Court of Appeals said that we failed to state a cause of action under Section 1983 because we didn't allege a Fourth Amendment violation, and they relied upon Graham versus Connor for that proposition. But that's not what Graham versus Connor said. Graham versus Connor said that claims for using excessive force in stopping, arresting, or making a seizure have to be asserted under the Fourth Amendment and its objective reasonableness standard. But as we've shown in our application for writ of error, claims outside of the seizure context can be based upon the substantive due process raised as substantive due process claims under the 14th Amendment. No question, there was no seizure in this case, as that term has been defined, but that doesn't mean there could not be an excessive force claim brought under Section 1983. It's a different standard under the 14th Amendment. Everything from recklessness, reckless or callous indifference, gross negligence, shock to the conscience, all kinds of standards that have been developed by federal courts around the country. But that wasn't the issue in this case. The issue was that the Court of Appeals said that we didn't state a claim because we didn't invoke the Fourth Amendment. And the point that we have is that you don't have to have a seizure in order to have an excessive force claim under Section 1983 for violation of the 14th Amendment's due process clause.
Under Section 1983, the officer would have an affirmative defense of qualified immunity, would he not?
Yes.
But you're saying if they violate Article 6701D, Section 24, a state law claim, that the officer would not have a defense of official immunity?
Well, that's true, but those, of course, are two different propositions. And, of course, in the concurring opinion in Travis was going to borrow or adopt or adapt that immunity standard from Wood versus Strickland, which of course later on the Supreme Court retreated from and emphasized instead just an objective element. But the point is that they're the federal claims are subject to that immunity analysis. State law claims are subject to a different immunity analysis.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, all of the argument and most of the briefing to this point has dealt, I guess, appropriately with law enforcement. Is there anything about the doctrine of immunity as you are advancing it that would limit its applicability to law enforcement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The doctrine of official immunity applies based on common law, based on satisfaction of three elements, that being within the force and scope of his authority, good faith, and discretion. And I think were other public officials able to establish those elements, it would apply equally. I would, however, point out that there's a great deal of discussion about quasi-judicial function. It's clear that an officer is performing a quasi-judicial function in attempting to apprehend suspects, especially when he's observed a violation of the law. And that is applicable with respect to the discretion element as well. I'd like to turn a little bit before I get into the 1983 claims to the discussion that focused on discretion and good faith, because I think that the Court of Appeals and that the respondents here have confused those elements somewhat. They tend, and I think he actually admitted it toward the end of his argument, to define discretion as basically a right. And they argue that he has no discretion to drive in due regard. And what they're really saying is he has no right to drive without due regard. And I think that is simply confusing the element of discretion with whatever analysis goes into the element of good faith. Discretion, as is clear based on prior case law, is defined as whether or not the officer is required to exercise independent judgment and independent decision-making in making a certain decision and taking a certain course of action. And essentially, the case law defines actions as being either ministerial or discretionary. I think as Justice Cornyn pointed out in the concurrence, I think as the Court of Appeals pointed out in Carpenter, it's quite clear that police decisions as to when to apprehend someone, how to apprehend someone, when to cease in their efforts to apprehend someone, are quite clearly discretionary, irrespective of the due regard statute here. It simply does not mandate and statutorily make an officer's decision to pursue one of ministerial rather than discretionary elements.
Does the common law of immunity, as you understand it, immunize a public employee for the unexcused violation of the statute?
The unexcused violation of the statute? I don't believe that it would, but I'm not sure that I fully understand the question. I think maybe I'd like to turn to Anderson for a moment. The United States Supreme Court, in an opinion styled Anderson v. Creighton, spoke at length on the qualified immunity doctrine in the context of a Section 1983 claim.
Well, counsel, if I could just follow up to Justice Doggett's question, a justification for the violation of the statute merely means that the case won't be submitted on a negligence per se issue, but then we'll have to be submitted on a common law negligence ground. Does that have anything to do with what affirmative defenses might be available as to whether the case is submitted on a negligence per se or a common law negligence ground?
It's not our view that the affirmative defense of immunity is determined whether there's a negligence claim or a negligence per se claim. No. It's our view that qualified immunity is an affirmative defense to any claim of negligence. And I'd like to go back to the Anderson case because I think it's instructive on the point. The Anderson case held that there would be qualified immunity where there was a reasonable belief in the lawfulness of the officer's conduct. And in defining that reasonableness standard, they didn't turn to the general negligence reasonable man standard that we're so familiar with. They turned instead to a much more limited definition of reasonableness. And they defined it by saying that the reasonable belief in the lawfulness of the action must be based on clearly established laws. And in discussing what that meant, they turned to the 14th Amendment due process by way of example. And they stated that this clause, this due process clause, is so vague and potentially expansive that if we were to say that any alleged violation of due process would in fact defeat immunity and make this a jury issue, that it would in fact make qualified immunity nothing more than a pleading defect, and would allow plaintiffs to, in all instances, avoid the defense of qualified immunity. And I think that's instructive with respect to how the standard for good faith in connection with immunity defense, we've urged negligence, should be evaluated, as well as to the way in which the due regard statute should be interpreted, because it is similarly expansive and vague in that there's really no way to objectively limit it without If we're going to say that defines an officer's discretion, then an officer's discretion is going to be statutorily limitless and only defined by a jury in each instance. And again, we would be forcing officers to go through a trial on the merits determined by a trier of fact in each instance in which they make a pursuit. That is simply not what the doctrine of qualified immunity exists to affect. It is not, and in fact, I point out, there's something that came up a great deal in Travis. The qualified immunity doctrine, there's a specific statute that provides that there's an interlocutory appeal for it. It is given that degree of importance by the court and the legislature that these cases should be determined when possible on a summary judgment basis. It is not something that should be in each instance mandatorily made something to be determined by a jury. I'd like to turn, if I could, briefly to the Section 1983 points that the respondents have become cross-petitioners on. It's essentially their position that Graham does not apply to all claims of excessive force against law enforcement officers, and we agree. The critical problem with that argument is that neither the Court of Appeals nor the petitioners have ever stated that it does apply to all such cases. It is clear on the face of Graham that it applies only to cases that arise in the course of making an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure. And I'd like to focus on that language, in the course of making an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure. Because in order to distinguish themselves from Graham and extricate themselves from the Fourth Amendment's analysis, they must demonstrate that their claim did not arise in the course of making an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure. And they can simply not succeed in that proof. It is quite clear that this claim, that respondent's Section 1983 claim, arose in the context of a police pursuit where the petitioner officers observed a violation of the law, turned on the lights and sirens, attempted to arrest and seize the respondents, that upon seeing the lights and sirens, the respondents attempted to
Chambers
flee.
Chambers had violated the law.
Chambers was on the back of a motorcycle that had violated the law and which the police officers were attempting to seize and arrest for that violation.
But he wouldn't have been
there. He would not have, ma'am. That is quite correct.
Well, if the officer had identified him and radioed in and found out he had an outstanding felony warrant, he sure would have gotten arrested.
Well, I think that is one of the points. That is the way in which law enforcement is done. That is correct. And oftentimes, more serious criminal offenders are apprehended because they are initially seen and apprehended for a more minor violation of the law, for something that occurred here, and when they are eventually arrested, it will then become clear when the standard searches are done that they, in fact, have arrest warrants against them, as was the case here. There was a felony arrest warrant out for Bradley Chambers, the respondent in this case. Turning back to the 1983 claim, however, respondents can simply not demonstrate that this claim did not arise in the course of making an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure. Their only argument that it did not is that the arrest had not been completed or the seizure had not been completed or successful at the time in which the accident occurred, and that position is simply untenable. The Graham Court made several statements that make it clear that the Fourth Amendment's protection, and thus the Fourth Amendment reasonableness test, applies both to the pursuit preceding an arrest, just as it applies to the arrest itself. The Supreme Court stated, when framing the issue, that the issue that they would be deciding was what constitutional standards would apply to claims of excessive force in the course of making an arrest, investigatory stop, or other seizure. I realize my time is up, but I'd like to just point out one more item, if I could, to the court.
What's your one last time?
Thank you. The court, in defining what factors should be analyzed and should be looked to in determining whether or not an officer's conduct was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, defined the following factor as one of those, and I quote, whether the officer, or rather the suspect, is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade arrest by flight. For that flight to be a factor in determining the Fourth Amendment's test and whether or not an officer complied with that test, it necessarily is the case that flight is subsumed within the protections of the Fourth Amendment and is therefore judged by the Fourth Amendment's test. And as such, it is that test and only that test which can apply to the respondent's Section 1983 claim. They did not allege a claim under the Fourth Amendment, and thus the petition was correctly, we were correctly granted summary judgment on that claim. Even had they alleged a claim under the Fourth Amendment, it's quite clear that they could not have succeeded under the test for seizure in both Brower and Hadar, the two recent Supreme Court cases.
Any other questions?
Just
One other, was there any contest over the issue of good faith at the summary judgment level?
At the summary judgment level? I do not believe. Quite frankly, I can't state that conclusively because I don't recall.
I don't recall anything. Let me be more specific. Was there any expert testimony?
There was not.
Offered to show that a reasonably prudent officer under these circumstances would not have pursued this motorcycle?
There was no expert in testimony introduced at the summary judgment level proceeding.
Thank you. Either way.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another recess.
Yeah, yeah.